cheating heart will make you weep. You'll cry and cry and try to sleep, but sleep won't come the whole night through. Your cheating heart will tell on you.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Alternet's Washington Bureau Chief Adele Stan, who writes for the AFL-CIO Now blog. She has served as a columnist and blogger for the American Prospect Online and as a featured essayist for The Guardian's Comment is Free site. Her most recent article at Alternet is Do Allegations of a 13-year Adulterous Affair Spell Doom for Herman Cain? Welcome to Background Briefing, Adele Stan. In your latest article, you have pointed out that unlike Newt Gingrich, who with his three marriages, two of them which ended in adulterous affairs, he in 2007 made a confession on Focus on the Family's James Dobson's radio show.
Right.
Who incidentally recently honored the deadbeat dad of the year, Joe Walsh, Congressman Joe Walsh, as a champion of family values. But
there you go.
I digress. Newt Gingrich confessed to adultery, which is, of course, one of the Ten Commandments he violated, but he was given redemption. And I guess the point here is that the Republican primary in Iowa is dominated by evangelical Christians, that means that Herman Cain is toast, right?
I think so, because he's not repentant. See, if he had come out and said, oh, I've done this terrible thing and I am confessing before you and before Jesus and before all of, and I ask forgiveness. You know, that is the Christian story, and you know, that is such a centerpiece of how when you go to evangelical services where they do altar calls and people are seeking a conversion experience. I mean, they basically go up and do a public sort of confession of, you know, how their lives were broken and confess their sins. But Cain is completely unrepentant, and yet he is an ordained Baptist minister. And I just don't see how he can possibly survive in the evangelical states, and two of them are very early, as you mentioned, Iowa and South Carolina. Their primary comes within several weeks of that. And he already blew it in New Hampshire by really standing up the editorial board of the Manchester Union Leader, which went on to endorse Newt Gingrich. So,
but by the way, he stood them up because he didn't want the editorial board meeting videotaped, which
right.
which is common practice. And it was the videotaping of his disastrous meeting before the paper in Minnesota, was it?
It was actually Milwaukee.
Milwaukee, right.
Wisconsin, yes.
And where he couldn't figure out what had gone on in Libya.
Right. So I do think that, you know, Herman Cain, I mean, I keep thinking there's going to be someday a great ballad of the Herman Cain because if you look at his life, I mean, this is a guy who has surmounted really incredible odds all along the way and been quite successful. And he had this long tail of success, rising to the upper echelons of corporate America as an African-American who came from out of the Jim Crow South. I mean, that is just an astonishing kind of a personal story. And then he's had all these different careers at which he's been pretty successful. And he survived stage 4 cancer. And And but it seemed like humility, his lack of humility, is what in the end is going to take him down.
Well, obviously, this is the fifth woman. The first could have been dismissed as some kind of smear, as he suggested. But the second, the third, the fourth, and now the fifth, it stretches credulity. But she went public. Ginger White went public on Atlanta's Fox 5. But Atlanta's Fox 5 had already received a tip about this affair, and apparently other news outlets already had.
Right.
It'd be interesting to find out who the tipster was. I mean, doesn't take a huge conspiratorial leap to think maybe the Newtster's involved here. No, of course not. I mean, I don't know that at all, but it just slipped off my tongue. What can I say?
Right. And, I mean, and the tipster apparently presented him or herself as somebody who was close to Ginger White. Mm-hmm. So we don't even know whether or not, Ginger White, gave her, permission
sure.
to the tipster or not for reasons of her own. But nonetheless, apparently she's credible enough that Herman Cain's own attorney gave a rather non-denial denial in the statement that he gave to the Atlanta news station, Fox 5, basically not denying that there was an affair, saying that if there was one, it was really it was nobody's business.
Right.
It's not a matter between Herman Cain and Ginger White.
Right. Well, there's a good chance, surely, Adele Stan, that L. Lynn Wood, Cain's attorney, probably asked him, as I'm sure Clinton's attorneys in the early days said, are there any more bimbo eruptions on the horizon?
Mm-hmm.
And he probably said no. So I suspect that Lynn Wood, more than anything, is covering himself and his own credibility, isn't he?
That would make sense. That would make total sense to me. Because it's very kind of an unusual circumstance where you have a political candidate absolutely denying, as Herman Cain has, a circumstance in which his attorney says, well, if it did happen, it's really not any of your business.
Right. The reason I suggested the idea that maybe there was somebody behind this tip, Adele Stan, is the simple fact that all of these campaigns have people or even a division euphemistically known as opposition research.
Oppo, yeah.
An oppo. And you'd think that it wouldn't take any kind of gumshoe to do the shoe leather on this one, surely, to find out that Herman Cain, it gives a whole new meaning to 999. I got nine women in Georgia. I got nine women in Tennessee, and I got nine women in South Carolina.
It's like an old blues song. Yeah, I mean, it's really quite amazing. But the thing that I think and you're right. I mean, they seem to have been rather public. I mean, they dined out. They dined out, and he took her on trips and all this kind of thing, according to her account of things. So it doesn't seem like, there would be any way to keep it secret. And Cain himself presaged that when he warned that other women would come forward to accuse him of things he'd never done. Well, I mean, that's not a standard fare for people to announce that there are going to be other accusations coming, but just don't pay any attention to them, But the thing about Cain, I mean, I just think he's a fascinating character in that, he really seems to have felt the need to try to get away with things. And yet he's surely a person of considerable personal resources in terms of tenacity, and he's certainly intelligent despite his lapses on foreign policy and whatnot. Those sorts of lapses seem to have been hubris. He didn't feel like he needed to know this stuff.
Well, he sure is a hell of a lot more interesting than that sort of rather crazed woman from Minnesota, and the and the you know the pay or play Texan and the pay to play Texan, or the nasty mean the world's highest paid historian from Georgia.
And I know a few historians. They wouldn't mind making that kind of joke.
And the boring you know corporate automaton. You know, it's pretty. It's a pretty dismal feel, and he sure as hell is making it interesting. What did you make the Adele Stand again, Washington bureau chief for alternate? What did you make of the Barney Frank's exit, referring to the Republican Party? He said, and I thought, you know, it actually probably makes sense, and it's awfully depressing if it's true, that the Republican Party, in terms of the people on the Hill and in the Senate, are either think like Michelle Bachmann, or they're afraid that if they don't go along with Michelle Bachmann's program, the somebody will run a somebody just like Michelle Bachmann against them in a primary.
Well, I think that, I think the latter is you know more the case, and that's what you know when I first started writing about the Tea Party movement in. You were kind enough to have me on the show when I did start writing about the Tea Party movement a couple of years ago. I mean, that was the thing that I was trying to tease out, was that they don't need a majority because of the way that they have used threats of primary challenges. So they don't really need a majority of people who think like them. They just need a majority of people who will vote like them out of fear. And I think that Barney Frank is on the money about that. I really do. And I do think, you know, it's going to be quite a loss to have him no longer in the Congress.
But isn't that the MO of a lot of the big powerful lobbies in Washington, D.C., AIPAC, the NRA, and Grover Norquist, where you threaten people in the primary with, you know, if you got a Democrat who is not playing ball with you, then you run somebody further to the left of them, and if you got a Republican incumbent who's not going along with your program, you run somebody further to the right of them in the primary.
I think it's an old political game. I mean, we've seen it for decades. However, I think that what you saw with the Tea Party movement and with the involvement of the Koch brothers in organizing the Tea Party movement was that it became systematized in a way that included a ground game that hadn't really previously, it had been done by the religious right through the, you know, or organizing evangelical churches. But never before had you had the right turn out into the streets in the way that you had the big Tea Party march through Washington in 2009 and all of these very raucous rallies on Capitol Hill. I mean, what they did was they took a page out of the playbook of really of the left, to create a street presence that they never had before. So that's rather terrifying, where on the one hand you have the institutional pressure coming from the lobbyists and the people who hold the purse strings, but you also have this kind of, you know, apparently grassroots army that is going to show up on your doorstep if you don't do what pleases them. And they also did a brilliant job looking at the Senate and how to control the Senate with a very small number of their own kind centered around South Carolina Senator Jim DeMint, because the rules of the Senate allow so few people to gum up the works. So, I mean, I think that what you're talking about is, yes, it's an old strategy, but I mean, it's an old, you know, it's an old tactic, but they applied new and very efficient strategies to deploy it in a way that really frightened party regulars into seeing things their way.
Well, that's what's so interesting about the Republicans, in the sense that they're a minority party, then they gain majority control, and the only way that they ever get majority control is to get Democrats to vote for them. And they sure as hell, the party that brought us the Wall Street crash, turned around and profited from it via this kind of front group, this repackaging of the far right of the party known as the Tea Party.
Right.
And they captured that outrage. The previous guest before you came on, Adele, I was asking him about the Occupy movements and whether their energy will translate into political activity in 2012. And as you know, they've already had a profound effect within the political zeitgeist by putting through this notion, I think, that's quite pervasive, the 99% versus the 1%. If it's their only achievement, it's an awfully big one just at that. But I'm afraid it doesn't look like there's going to be any such symmetry on the left like there was with the Tea Party capturing, 65 House seats or something.
They're not focused.
But they're hostile towards the Democratic Party. At least a lot of them are, you know.
Right. And on the one hand, that's quite understandable when you look at the Wall Streeters around Barack Obama and the fact that, the finance industry has had profound, impact on both parties. I mean, even Barney Frank was hardly pure in that regard. I mean, he was not always the most progressive on financial regulation and the like. So, I mean, I can understand from an ideological point of view how that is. But also, I think that this has long been a conundrum of the left, where sort of the popular sentiment is not really married to an electoral strategy in a way that is really intentional about winning. You have an ideological movement, and then you have a whole sort of institutional structure, a liberal institutional structure that is focused on electing Democrats, and the two don't necessarily play nicely together. Where the right has, been very focused on an electoral strategy that starts at, the level of dog catcher. They've been doing it for 40 years, taking over school boards and
right.
And that's how they took over the party.
But I think there's a psychological difference there between the political activism on the right and the political activism on the left. I think on the left they tend to be much more self-righteous and faint-hearted, and the right don't care about ideological inconsistencies. They're much more focused on power. They're much more disciplined. And they're much, less easily disappointed, shall we say.
I think that's true. You'll hear lots of grousing, behind the scenes among right-wingers about so-and-so not being quite, anti-choice enough or whatever. But they will make sure that that person gets elected if it's a choice between that person and a Democrat. Absolutely.
Well, Adele, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thanks so much for having me, Ian.
Bye-bye. Again, I've been speaking with Adele Stan, who's Alternate's Washington Bureau Chief. She also writes for the AFL-CIO Now blog and served as a columnist and blogger for the American Prospect Online as a featured essayist for the Guardians of England's Comment is Free site. Her most recent article at Alternate is Do Allegations of a 13-Year Adulterous Affair Spell Doom for Herman Cain? We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back in a moment.